When it came to the merging of military matters and politics, Bryce Kleiber had no equal. Huang must already have realized that he picked the wrong venue for this fight. He picks up a data pad and pretends to read notes, his eyes fixed on a spot in the middle of the pad. When Johansson leans forward and whispers something, Admiral Huang's jaw tightens, and he acts as if he does not hear him.
In the interest of time, I will not go into every detail of this ship.
Why not give us a complete rundown?
As I was saying, a complete set of plans has been forwarded to each of you. As the Linear Committee has not gone public with this project, your discretion is requested. I would, however, like to go over a few of the finer points of the ship. The Doctrinaire has 12 decks and a bridge. She measures a full 2 miles from wingtip to wingtip. The Doctrinaire has 4 launch tubes, each of which is loaded with a complete squadron of 70 Tomcat fighters for deep space combat. She also has...
2/3 of the ship is taken up by the engines.
Quite right, Admiral Wong. With a ship of this size, power generation is a major concern, especially for a ship that is self-broadcasting.
Admiral Kleiber, you have not yet told us the regeneration time needed to power your broadcast engine. I believe we just learned that the Mogats have re-outfitted their broadcast engines so that they can charge and broadcast every 8 minutes. How long will it take your Colossus to charge its broadcast engine, Admiral Kleiber?
Fair question. Our best intelligence showed that the ships in the Galactic Central Fleet required 15 minutes per broadcast. We set a higher standard, of course.
How long?
The broadcast engines in the Doctrinaire require 10 minutes.
10 minutes?
That is correct.
Uh-huh. 10 minutes. So, assuming you manage to fly this juggernaut to the battle before the GCF ships depart, they will simply be able to broadcast off before you can recharge your engines and follow them.
Well, of course you realize that we have no way of tracking a self-broadcasting ship. We'd have no way of knowing where the GCF ships had broadcast themselves.
We're all quite aware of that, Admiral Kleiber. My point is simple. If the GC fleet appears... Oh, for the purposes of this discussion, we'll say they appear near Olympus Cree. And let's say you have a 3-minute response time. It seems unlikely, but let's say you manage to get your Colossus ship there in 3 minutes. Your ship will have 5 minutes to engage the enemy before they fly off to another target, very likely their primary target, while you sit around charging up the Doctrinaire's broadcast engine. Brilliant plan, Admiral. Sure. You've created a $1 trillion boondoggle.
That is a concern.
Admiral Wong, you'll note that I said broadcast engines. The Doctrinaire does, in fact, have 2 such units, each working independent of the other. One engine recharges, while the other one broadcasts. The Doctrinaire can self-broadcast every 5 minutes. Admiral Wong... We never believed that the Separatists would be so foolish as to commit their entire fleet into a single battle. The Doctrinaire was built around the notion that they would stage their battles with decoys and feigned attacks along several fronts.
What about armament?
The board behind Kleiber shifts to an exterior schematic of the ship.
She has 2 massive forward cannons for bombarding stationary targets such as cities and military bases. These cannons are both laser and particle beam enabled. The ship has 300 particle beam turrets along with 20 missile stations and 15 torpedo stations. And as I mentioned a moment ago, she has a complement of 280 Tomcat fighters. Should the enemy attempt to attack her, the Doctrinaire could annihilate the entire GC fleet. Oh, and Thurston, you'll appreciate this. Look at the shield antennas. This is an entirely new technology. We've developed a cylindrical shield. Those rings on the end of the wings project a seamless shield that covers the entire ship.
And the Mogats haven't got a clue.
Well, perhaps, but I am concerned about that. We paid for the ship with Linear Committee funds so that we could slip under the radar, but apparently we didn't go undetected.
Yes, it does appear that you had a breach of security.
Smith takes the dais, and formality creeps back into the session. The officers return to their seats.
Admiral, While we are on the subject of secret operations...
General, my intelligence unit located the construction of a large project in deep space. Our radar showed repeated broadcasts in the Perseus arm. We had no idea that this was Admiral Kleiber's operation when we began investigating.
Admiral Huang, General Accounting found an anomaly in your books. Apparently, your branch has had a $6 billion increase in spending on toilet paper and uniforms. We all hope the lack of one of these items has not led to the need for the other.
I have a staff that goes through the books and reports...
But a $6 billion expenditure, surely that would not go unnoticed.
Well, perhaps our inventory was...
When my staff looked into it, we discovered that your procurement team placed no additional orders for either toilet paper or uniforms, Admiral. What we found was that a mothballed military base was reactivated on Earth. I understand that you have a cloning plant on the island of Oahu. Is that correct?
That is correct, General. The Navy is experimenting with a new set of genes to improve our SEAL operations. I was unaware of any regulations stating that the Navy had to clear its research projects with members of other branches.
A video feed of an Adam Boyd in a firefight appears on the display board. It is a brief 5-second loop that repeats itself again and again. I recognize the image. It is from the battle on Ravenwood. Across the room, Admiral Thurston looks particularly interested in this discussion. Huang's newly cloned SEALs operate off of Thurston's command ship.
When were you planning on telling us about this new project?
General John Kellen is the 39-year-old Secretary of the Army. There is a centuries-old tradition of jealousy that runs between the SEALs and Kellen's Rangers. Freeman and I headed for Sad Sam's at 2100 hours. It was Thursday night during a slow season for tourists, and the city seemed deserted. We found a drive-in restaurant just up the street from the palace and ordered hamburgers, then ate in the car.
You got that scar here?
The scar ran through the eyebrow over my left eye. Three smaller scars formed parallel stripes across my left cheek, just under the eye socket.
This is the place.
I got the scars fighting an Adam Boyd clone. I beat him, had certainly put him in the hospital, but not before he dug into my face and back with his talon-like fingers, giving me lacerations that went all the way to the bone. As I finished my burger, the front doors opened and a mob flowed out.
Fights must be over. That's our cue.
The crowd thinned as we made our way across the empty street. Most of the people had walked in from the waterfront where the buses ran. An usher in a white shirt and black vest approached me as I came to the door.
The show is over.
My friend dropped his wallet somewhere around his seat.
The man looked at Freeman, nodded, and stepped out of my way. We walked through the dark hall toward the auditorium, the usher following from a safe distance. Freeman and I walked across the floor and headed for the tunnel to the dressing rooms. I paused for a moment to look at the ring, then pushed the door open.
Where are you going?
The metal doors opened to a brightly lit hallway with a concrete floor and cinder block walls.
Do you know where we're going?
I've never been back here.
Halfway down the hall, we found a pair of emerald green double doors that led to the locker room. It was unlocked, so I let myself in. Freeman remained outside to deal with the security guards that would quickly be on their way. The men inside the locker room seemed not to care that I had entered. A man with a towel wrapped around his waist strode past me without so much as a sideways glance. His hair was wet. He had a square chest and muscular arms, all of which was covered with welts and bruises.
I know you.
Not likely.
In ran the usher.
There's a giant black man out there!
That's nothing. There's a Liberator clone in here. You're the one that killed that Adam Boyd guy. Everything moving along in here?
Just fine. You say he died?
Yeah. I helped drag his ass from the ring. That boy was dead. You caved in the front of his skull.
I heard he went on to win another 50 fights.
Not that, Boyd.
What makes you think I'm a Liberator?
Boyd said you were.
I thought you said I killed him.
Not the one you killed, the next one. We had at least three of them. At least three. They were clones. Had to be. You offed one, and two others got busted up pretty bad. So you are a Liberator, right?
Is there going to be a Boyd fighting tomorrow?
Nah. The Boyds stopped coming a couple years ago. They're gone. Left the island.
Do you know where they went?
No, but I know where they used to live.
But
What is the point of creating a new strain of clones? We've been using volunteers and special forces for 600 years.
My clones are more effective in battle, General Kellen. They are more expendable, less concerned about self-preservation, and far more lethal. This new strain was developed specifically for commando operations. They're quick, think independently, and are programmed to kill.
Well, that sounds an awful lot like Liberator clones.
Kleiber's Liberators were never in the same league. Kleiber's clumsy attempt at clone-making may have been enough for the Mogats.
Is that so? I understand that you lost a squad of 10 clones in an operation in Scutum Crux.
That is true, General Smith. They were killed running drills on a planet called Ravenwood. Over a 4-year period, we ran hundreds of drills and only lost one squad.
And how many Marines did you kill off?
I guess in the neighborhood of 500 to 600. Ravenwood was a major success. We sent squads of 10 clones against platoons of 42 Marines, and we only lost once. Most drills ended without the loss of a single commando. We also ran tests in a tough man competition in Hawaii.
Sad Sam's Palace?
I suspect many of you are familiar with the palace's tough man challenge. If there's a better testing ground for hand-to-hand combat, I have not found it. We had a clone fighting under the name Adam Boyd entered in that competition. He racked up a record of 250 wins and one loss.
200 wins and one loss? How do we get our hands on the guy who beat him? That's who we should be cloning.
The next morning, Freeman and I headed out of town and into the countryside where farmers grew pineapples. We drove deep into the farming country. Antique railroad tracks ran along the side of the road at one point, and we crossed a steel-framed bridge that spanned a stream. I thought the countryside was beautiful. Freeman seemed not to notice it at all. We passed Wheeler Air Force Base. It was dark and abandoned. We did not stop. A few miles farther, we approached another military complex called Schofield Barracks, a defunct army base. Schofield Barracks looked a lot like Wheeler and the defunct naval base at Pearl Harbor, just an empty campus with sturdy 2- and 3-story buildings. From the road, it looked a good deal larger than Wheeler, but not even half the size of the Pearl Harbor facility. There were no immediate signs of life, but there was one difference at Schofield Barracks. The main gate was wide open.
You think they're expecting us?
Looks that way.
Finding our way across the base was easy enough. Most of the roads were overgrown with weeds, but one artery was trimmed and neat. The sidewalks in this part of the base gleamed in the sunlight, and the asphalt on the streets was not cracked. We passed a courtyard in which the weeds had only started to grow wild. The grass was knee-high, and the trees wanted trimming. We found a parking lot in which the stalls were clearly painted, and Freeman parked.
We're supposed to go there.
The building was 3 stories tall. Its architecture was a cross between 20th century American military and 16th century Spanish, combining rounded arches and thick stucco walls. The lights were off, but the front doors of the building hung wide open.
An open invitation.
I had no gun, but Freeman had his pistol. He carried it in the open now, holding it in his right arm, which hung almost limp at his side. He seemed so relaxed. We walked straight toward the building and right in the door. Even after Freeman found a light switch and turned on the lights, the darkness in this building seemed almost palpable. Most of the furniture had been removed from this hallway. There were no chairs. Bulletin boards lined one of the walls. One of these bulletin boards was covered with rows of 8x10 photographs, and the light from the windows reflected on their glossy finish. Beside the bulletin board sat a communications console. We approached. 5 rows of 5 photographs, 25 pictures in all, stretched across the bulletin board. Each of them was a picture of me. There were pictures of me entering Kleiber's C-64 transport right after the evacuation team brought it back into the hangar at the dry docks. There was a picture of me climbing out of my Starliner in Honolulu. There was one picture of me in the International Marketplace, and 2 of me and Freeman outside of Sad Sam's Palace, one of us entering and one of us leaving.
I think they are sending you a message.
The message was obvious. The photographer could just as easily have used a rifle with a sniper scope as a camera with a telephoto lens. I reached over and switched on the communications console. Che Huang's face appeared on the screen.
Are you always this slow, Lieutenant?
Hello, Huang. What do you want?
I did not kill Kleiber.
Not by yourself. You had one of your SEAL clones do it for you. I have the video feed from the dry dock security. You had a clone on the maintenance team that cleaned Kleiber's transport.
I did send a SEAL to visit Kleiber's transport. He installed listening and video devices throughout the ship.
I didn't hear anything about bugs on the transport.
Golan security didn't look for surveillance equipment. Why don't you have your friends back at the dry docks sweep the main cabin and the late admiral's room for bugs? Think about it, Harris. Why would I kill Kleiber?
Let's see. Petty jealousy? Old rivalries? Just for the fun of it? To take control of the Doctrinaire?
I already had control of the Doctrinaire. I took it away from Kleiber during the summit.
I saw the summit. You didn't have anything.
You have been busy. Perhaps you weren't watching the feed closely. By the time the summit ended, I had command of the Doctrinaire, and Kleiber had nothing but the fleet.
Commanding the fleet isn't being in control?
Once the battle begins, the ship's captain makes the decisions. When historians discuss great battles, they won't bother mentioning the fleet. Kleiber knew it. I suppose you saw the old fool sulking once I got my suggestion past Smith and the rest of them. He did not say a word for the rest of the meeting. He just sat there stewing. I got everything I wanted. History will remember me as the Secretary of the Navy who won the war. I'll place Robert Thurston over the ship. He'll be the commander who won the key battle. And Kleiber? Kleiber would have been a footnote. He would have been the man who brought up the rear. Harris, if you don't believe anything else I tell you, believe this. I got what I wanted.
Why come to me?
I want your help.
Help you? Why should I help you?
We both want the same thing, Harris. We want to kill the people who killed Kleiber. Now that I have the Doctrinaire, I won't be safe until they are dead. You can clear my name while you're at it. You are not the only one who thinks I sabotaged Kleiber's transport. Once Smith and the other Joint Chiefs see the video feed with that SEAL entering the ship...
I saw your SEAL in the feed. I saw your spy, too.
My spy?
What about Halvorsen? He was in the landing bay, too.
Halvorsen?
Wasn't Rear Admiral Halvorsen working for you?
Halvorsen? I wouldn't work with an idiot like Tom Halvorsen. He was Kleiber's man.
He was your spy on the Doctrinaire.
Johansson was my spy. I should have thought that was obvious. He sat with my staff during the summit. He flew back to D.C. with me. Landed Johansson was my eyes on the project.
So what was Halvorsen doing by the hangar?
I've seen the security feed. Halvorsen isn't on it.
Perhaps you weren't watching the feed closely. When the janitors left the hangar, they passed Admiral Halvorsen. He watched your boy come in, then followed him away from the hangar.
Halvorsen? He may have been there, but he wasn't working for me. It sounds to me as if you've got your first clue, Sherlock. What you need now is to follow up on it.
This is the moment when Che Huang demonstrates his prowess in the dark arts of politics. Now that he has weathered the counterattack about his clones, Huang draws back his fangs and sinks them into Admiral Kleiber.
Admiral Kleiber, powerful as this super ship of yours is, do you really think it can handle more than 500 enemy ships?
No, of course not. We need support ships. And the optimum situation is to engage no more than 10 or 20 dreadnoughts per battle.
I really must congratulate you. You have created a fine weapon. I honestly believe that this ship will be the weapon that wins the war. How would a fleet be able to support this ship? You haven't talked the Linear Committee into funding a self-broadcasting fleet, have you?
I've assembled a ready alert fleet that will remain near the broadcast network. It's a small fleet now, but we'll find more ships for it. The fleet will have flash access to the broadcast computer on board the Doctrinaire. Anytime she self-broadcasts, her travel information will be relayed to the ships in the fleet.
But will they be able to get to her in time to assist?
They will, General Smith. The ready alert ships can override the network. They can enter the disks and override the system to broadcast them directly to the Doctrinaire.
At this point, I notice that both of the seats behind Kleiber are empty. Admiral Halvorsen has gone somewhere. I check the summit clock and note the time. It is 3 p.m, according to Washington, D.C. time, which is the clock used by the dry docks for the duration of the summit.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Of course, you'll need a skilled administrator to handle the logistics. Strategy and logistics. They seem to be the keys. A great battle strategist at the helm of the Doctrinaire, and the right logistical support to make sure that the ship does not fail.
What's your point?
It seems to me that the Fleet Admiral's skills are wasted commanding a lone ship, even a great ship such as the Doctrinaire. You are the highest-ranking officer in the Unified Authority Navy. Your command should not be limited to one lone boat. You should be in command of a fleet.
I will not relinquish control of the Doctrinaire.
Of course not. This is your project. The Doctrinaire is your ship. I am simply suggesting that you should command the entire fleet as well as the ship itself. If the Doctrinaire is part of a fleet, you should have the highest authority in that fleet. Of course, you would use the Doctrinaire as your command ship. She is your ship. The Doctrinaire will always be your ship.
The remainder of the meeting is unspectacular. Neither Che Huang nor Bryce Kleiber speak again. And when the meeting adjourns, Kleiber is the first officer to reach the door of the conference room. He meets me at the door, looking old and depressed. The carrot that Bryce Kleiber dangled in front of me, Che Huang delivered. An honorable discharge. With just a word from Huang, I was Lieutenant Wason Harris, Unified Authority Marines, retired.
What are you going to do next?
I need to pick up Halverson's trail. Whoever put the cables on Bryce Kleiber's ship was working with Halverson. That means Halverson was spying for the Separatists or the Confederate Arms.
It looks that way.
Last place I saw him was in the Golan Dry Docks. I figure that's the place to start.
Freeman dropped me off at Honolulu Airport. Nobody stopped me when I asked for my plane, and I left Hawaii without incident. I was, for all intents and purposes, a free man. I put in a call to Colonel McAvoy, the head of security at the Golan Dry Docks, as I started the long trip to Mars. I asked him if he had searched Kleiber's C-64 for listening devices. He said no, but said that he would and that he would get back to me shortly. 10 minutes after we hung up, Colonel McAvoy called back.
Harris, you were right. I don't know how you knew it, but we discovered a wide array of spying devices.
That clears Adam Boyd.
Wait, spying devices clear the guy?
I talked with Huang. Boyd was Huang's man, and Huang admits having Boyd plant the devices. Why bother planting mics and cameras on the ship if you plan to kill the passengers?
Spying is an alibi for murder? Well, that's a new one.
I need whatever information you can get me on the rest of the maintenance team. And get me anything you can on Admiral Halverson. I need to know where he went before he left the dry docks. And I need to know if he went alone.
I leaned back in my chair and stared out the window at the endless blackness of outer space. Stars winked in the distance. Out here, I could see the colors of the planets. Jupiter, a dust-colored marble with horizontal stripes, loomed off to the right. Mars, not really red, but tan, with a rust-colored patina, floated in the darkness dead ahead. I looked back at the dimly lit cabin behind me. The passenger seat was no more comfortable than my pilot's chair, but I liked the idea of leaving the cockpit. Taking my media link shades, I slipped into the first chair behind the cockpit and reclined it as far back as it would go. The top story of the day was Bryce Kleiber's funeral. Several sites, both civilian and military, showed the service in its entirety. The faces of the guests taking up the front two rows of Arlington Chapel were remarkably similar to those sitting around the table at the summit. Huang was there. I expected him to have a secret grin, or at least the smug sneer with which he customarily greeted the world, but he did not. Huang stared straight ahead at the glossy black casket that lay on the stand. He did not look arrogant or satisfied. If anything, he looked worried.
Hello, Judas.
I saw Captain Leonid Johansson was there as well. Captain was a much higher rank in the Navy than it was in the Marines, but even as a Navy captain, Johansson looked like a piker in this setting. In the grand tradition of Washington, D.C. funerals, this service droned on and on. I wondered if I would reach Mars before it ended. After the sermon came the eulogies. I thought military men kept their speeches short, but General Alexander Smith of the UAAF went on for 45 friggin' minutes. Next came two of Kleiber's pals in politics. I expected them to drone on, and they did not disappoint. A small red emergency beacon flickered on and off at the bottom of my vision. By flicking my eyes at the flashing symbol, I brought up the call.
Harris, are you seeing this?
Seeing what? Ray, nice to hear from you. Yes, the flight has been good so far. And how are you?
Gateway Outpost is under attack.
I knew Gateway. It was a habitable planet in the area where the Orion and Sagittarius arms met. The space around Gateway was a high-security zone, even though Sagittarius and Orion were the only arms that remained fully loyal to Earth. Without saying a word, I switched to the Galactic News Service.
The picture before my eyes was one of grand destruction. The legend on the screen said, New Gibraltar, in light blue letters that seemed to glow over the pitch-black sky. New Gibraltar was the capital city of Gateway. Gateway Outpost, the local marine base, was on the outskirts of the city. In the center of the picture, a dying marine base crumbled before my eyes. Its three green particle beam cannons fired into the air, lighting up the midnight sky. On a major base like this Gateway Outpost, there should have been 100 cannons. No buildings remained on the streets around the fort. A red beam, as wide around as a highway tunnel, flashed down from the sky. It seared one corner of the fort. When did this happen?
The attack started a couple of minutes ago.
There was movement on the street near the base of the fort. 20 men, maybe as many as 30, skirted around the remains of blasted buildings and wrecked vehicles. They were on foot, running quickly, and hiding behind cover. The scouts have arrived.
It has to be a demolition team. There aren't enough of them for anything else.
Who are they?
The Pentagon won't speculate until after the battle. I'm guessing they're MOGADs. Amos Crowley is probably someplace nearby coordinating the attack.
Freeman and Crowley had history, and Freeman wanted to settle that score. The majority of the Marines in the base must have been dead or wounded. However many were left, they did not put up much of a fight as the commandos closed in. Using an optical command, I brought up an on-the-spot audio analysis.
Enemy ships continue to batter the city of New Gibraltar from outside Gateway's atmosphere, while enemy troops now storm the marine facility. Reports suggest that there may be as many as 10 battleships attacking the city.
On the screen, the commandos turned to retreat. They backed away from the fort and headed toward a single transport under the cover of a bullet and rockets barrage. The last of the commandos boarded. In the distance, the firefly glow of armored transport rockets vanished into space.
Watch the fort.
The MOGATs had placed high-yield radiation bombs around the walls of the fort. For a moment, I sat in that plush cabin thinking my shades had died. Then I realized that the site I had been watching was no longer in operation. After identifying me and scanning my plane, traffic control at the Golan dry docks brought me in through a partially sealed aperture and armed guards walked me to the security station. The last time I passed through the posts at this security station, I was identified as Lieutenant Wason Harris, Marine on the Lam. This time, I was a retired Marine, and I was coming to visit the head of the Golan security, Colonel Clarence McAvoy. I handed my papers to the guard. He scanned them quickly.
Welcome to the dry docks, Colonel.
I looked over and saw that all the guards at the post now saluted me. I returned the salute and moved on.
Colonel McAvoy is expecting you, sir. He left word that he wanted to walk you to your meeting personally.
Very well. I was still trying to figure out how I could have suddenly become a colonel when McAvoy walked up to greet me.
Colonel Harris? You've gone through the ranks more quickly than any soldier I have known. Weren't you a lieutenant last time I saw you?
I retired after that.
Well, come on, Colonel. I thought I should roll out the red carpet for you, just in case.
In case of what?
In case you're on the Joint Chiefs next time I see you. Your pal, Huang, called for you. He told me to have you call him the moment you landed. Colonel?
Welcome back, Harris. You've been recalled to active service. And as a colonel. I never thought I would see a clone make colonel, but desperate times call for desperate measures.
Huang looked more tired than he had at the funeral. Dark bags had formed under his dark brown eyes. No trace of that cocky smile showed on his face.
And the reason for this?
Clarence Harris. Only officers with the rank of colonel or higher are cleared to view the information I'm going to show you. Don't worry about the commission. I don't want to leave you in the Corps any longer than I need to. I don't suppose you can guess how long the siege on Gateway Outpost lasted?
I watched the feed. It was fast.
Real fast. No guesses?
No.
8 minutes. Almost to the second.
I must be missing something.
Shit, Harris. You're supposed to be bright. 8 minutes, Harris. 8 specking minutes. 8 minutes. The amount of time it takes GCF ships to power up and self-broadcast. You couldn't figure that out on your own. Judas in heaven. What did Clyber see in you? I'm sure you've seen the video feed of the ground attack. You haven't seen this.
Satellite video showing the surface of Gateway appeared in my media link shades. The screen flashed as lightning danced across the scene. I saw the 4 battleships from the Galactic Central Fleet only as silhouettes against the glowing surface of the planet.
Their hulls looked black as coal. They were shadows. The ships had a deformed diamond shape. They were long, not wide, with blunted corners at their bow and stern. They dove down to the edge of the atmosphere, and green dots flashed on the surface as the Marines down below fired cannons at them.
Concentrated firepower, the mark of a well-trained commander. All of their laser fire hit within a 5-block radius. Whoever led this assault knew his tactics.
In the bottom corner of the screen, a small window showed the gateway outpost. Laser blasts rained down on the fort and the streets surrounding it. As the attack began, the cannons along the walls of the fort flashed like strobe lights. That cannon fire slowed as hit after hit tore into the walls of the fort.
Now, this is interesting. The GCF ships appeared 1 minute ago to the second. In that minute, the Marine base has focused all of its weapons on the capital ships. Standard procedure.
The screen froze. What I saw was one flame. It looked no more significant than a firefly as it penetrated the atmosphere.
That is the transport. It will take that transport precisely 1 minute to land.
The little flame seemed to shrink to nothing as the transport raced down to the planet. In the small window on my screen, New Gibraltar wilted quickly. The invading ground force stormed the fort, then ran off. At 7 minutes, the transport rejoined the battleships. 1 minute later, the entire invasion force was gone.
Call themselves the Hinode Fleet.
Hinode? The Japanese population on Ezra Cree called their capital city Hinode. Do you think there is a connection?
I don't want to guess. That's your job.
My job?
Yes, Colonel, your job. It came with the commission.
What about finding the guy?
The Republic is under attack. We knew about the Mogat instigators and the Confederate arms. We knew about the GC Fleet. You get to figure out why GCF ships are using a Japanese name.
Doing a little scouting before you take them on in the doctrinaire?
Yes. You get me movements and capabilities on that fleet. You get me a profile on the officers commanding those ships. You help me win this war.
And the guy who killed Kleiber?
Harris, once that fleet is destroyed, you can do whatever you want to Halvorsen. Get me what I want, and I will make you a very rich, very retired Liberator clone.
I'll need help.
You want men?
One. I have a partner.
Freeman. I've heard about him.
He's going to need access to whatever information you give me. And he won't help me if it means he has to enlist.
Do what you need to. Tell who you need to tell. Spend whatever money you need. I'm giving you a blank check.
Okay.
Where will you start?
New Columbia.
Why New Columbia?
Because Jimmy Callahan is a two-bit know-nothing and Billy the Butcher Patel tried to kill him.
What are you talking about?
There's a two-bit thug on New Columbia who thought he was a big fish. He sold supplies to the Mogats or the Confederates and thought he was a player. He tried to sell out Patel and nearly got himself killed. Remember the Safe Harbor bombing? Callahan was the one they were going after. I figured they wanted to make an example out of Callahan, but now I have another idea.
What does this have to do with Kleiber?
I never stopped to figure out how they knew about Callahan. Kleiber was the one who sent me to meet with him. If Kleiber knew about it, Halvorsen must have known as well. Halvorsen must have known something else, too, like where Callahan was getting his supplies.
Did Patel get him?
I locked him up in the local Marine base brig for safekeeping.
And you think he knows something?
He's too small-time and too stupid to have set a deal up with the Confederates himself. Somebody with bigger ambitions must have used him as a middleman. I need to sweat the name out of him.
You'd better get there quickly. Intelligence says the Confederates are going after New Columbia next. We're already evacuating the planet. I told you you've got a blank check on this. You can spend whatever you need. I'll send you whatever equipment you need. And one more thing. I don't think I need to tell you this, Harris, but just in case, feel free to kill anyone that gets in your way.
Earth date, March 23rd, 2512 AD. City, Safe Harbor. Planet, New Columbia. Galactic position, Orion Arm. A fighter carrier and two destroyers floated just a few miles away, guarding the broadcast discs that orbited New Columbia. After considering the attack on New Gibraltar, the Pentagon decided to evacuate Safe Harbor.
You're flying into Safe Harbor?
I had told Colonel McAvoy my plans.
They're evacuating the planet. The only people there are going to be Marines and looters. Come to think of it, you might fit right in.
I traveled toward the planet at the intolerably slow pace of 3,000 miles per hour, aware that below me were Marine, Army, and Air Force cannons that tracked my every move.
By the time I reached New Columbian space, my ship had been scanned so many times that the security computers even knew which of my bones had pins in them.
Starliner A-10-2034, this is Safe Harbor Spaceport. Come in.
This is Starliner A-10-2034.
Starliner A-10-2034, we are evacuating this planet.
So I've been told.
I show that you are Marine. Please confirm.
Colonel Wason Harris, Unified Authority Marine Corps.
You've chosen to use a civilian landing facility, Colonel. Are you aware that there is a Marine base with a landing field just outside of town?
I am aware of that.
We can offer you landing assistance. Please be advised that this spaceport will close within the next 3 hours. All traffic control will close at that time. Should you choose to leave your ship here, this facility cannot be held responsible for your ship.
Got it.
Can't dock you out of this, can I, Colonel?
You got a problem down there?
Yeah, I can't spare the men to check in your ship. Everyone I have is busy sending up transports.
That's fine.
I flew down through an evening sky, penetrating a thick layer of clouds as my approach slowed to a few hundred miles per hour. The weather had turned bad over Safe Harbor. Rain fell in heavy drops that burst across my windows. Below me, the city was dark. Not a light shone in the forest of skyscrapers that covered Safe Harbor. No street lights shined. The city may have looked lifeless, but the air above it fairly bristled with movement. I looked up through the top corner of my rain-spattered windshield and saw the darting profiles of three F-19s passing above me like shadows against the steel-wool clouds. Against the jungle of shadows that was the city of Safe Harbor, the spaceport looked like an eruption of light. Two lines of strobe lanterns clicked on and off along the runway, creating dashes of midnight blue. In the distance, white glare poured out of a row of hangars at the edge of the runway. Lights shone around the outside of the air terminal, and more lights spilled from the windows. I landed the Starliner on the edge of the runway and coasted toward the hangars. The hangar crew drove me to the main terminal of the spaceport. In the terminal, long lines of people sat silently clutching their belongings. The richest people, able to buy their way to the front of the line, had left first. They formed lines that snaked back and forth the entire length of the lobby. Rows of people in perfectly straight lines, standing so crowded together that the lines disappeared altogether. I walked towards the main entrance. Stepping out of the terminal, I entered a cold, wet night. Puddles covered the sidewalk leading away from the terminal building. A line of streetlights stretched as far as the parking garage. Beyond that, a shroud of inky darkness hid everything from view. I stole a car. I didn't have any other options. In honor of Billy the Butcher, I found a sporty little Paragon. I threaded my way through the spaceport parking lot and drove into town. There was something eerie about traveling through an abandoned city that reminded me of swimming underwater. Driving down dark streets lined by lifeless buildings, my isolation seemed to amplify itself. I looked into storefronts that were as dark as caves. It wasn't just that the lights were off. Life itself was gone. I drove past the movie house where I had met Jimmy Callahan and watched The Battle for Little Man. The entrance was a black hole. The Mogats and the secessionists may have chased everybody else away, but Callahan was still on the planet, right where I left him, locked up in a Marine-based brig. The irony was that the very spot where I had placed him for safekeeping would soon be the most dangerous location on the planet. I was driving through uptown Safe Harbor and turned a corner. The block in front of me was completely demolished. For a moment, I thought the attack must have begun, and then I recognized where I was. This was the neighborhood that Patel bombed. Only 3 weeks had passed since that bombing. 2 weeks and an era. Something far more dangerous than Billy the Butcher Patel was coming to New Columbia. Who would have believed it? Jimmy Callahan, who had talked so big and gotten himself into so much trouble, might just be the key to winning the war. I expected to see looters hiding in shadows, moving through alleys, and breaking into buildings. Instead, I ran into roadblocks. 5 soaked and miserable-looking soldiers in camouflaged ponchos flagged me down. They had M27s strapped over their shoulders, and there were machine gun nests on either side of their barricade.
Nice car.
The soldier was a corporal. You mind if I don't get out? I don't want to get the upholstery wet.
Sure. Do you have papers for that car?
How about these? I handed him my military ID.
Colonel? Our scanner says this car belongs to James Walker. I don't suppose you can prove that he loaned you this vehicle.
No, Corporal, I can't.
Then we have a bit of a problem, Colonel. We've been sent out to prevent looting. That includes the borrowing of cars.
How far is Fort Washington from here?
You don't know?
I just flew in, Corporal.
Fleet headquarters dispatched me to see what I can do to prepare this planet for an attack.
I heard air traffic was stacked up for hours.
Getting out is a problem. There's a line all the way up to the disk and more people waiting in the spaceport. Coming in is a breeze. Who wants to go to a planet that's about to get smashed?
That seemed to satisfy him. The corporal smiled and nodded.
Sir, I can't let you pass in that car.
I understand.
Tell you what, sir. You park the car over there.
He pointed to a nearby alley.
Then I'll give you a ride to Fort Washington in our Jeep.
You don't mind?
Base Command, this is Post 15 in Sector A, come in.
The corporal must have received the response through an unseen earpiece.
I have an incoming Marine Colonel looking for Fort Washington, requesting permission to drive him. That is correct. I said a Marine Colonel. Yes, that would be the equivalent of a Colonel in the Marine Corps. Okay, I'm clear to drive you to the base.
I appreciate it.
Leave the keys in the Paragon. Just in case.
You know anything about hot wiring cars?
No, sir.
I'll leave the ignition running.
I turned the car around and backed into the nearest alley. The corporal led me to his Jeep, a sturdy little five-seat auto with a hard top. Once out of the rain, I put my pistol in my ruck and pulled out my M27. I grabbed two extra clips and hid them in my jacket.
You expecting a war?
Better safe than spect.
Colonel, we have roadblocks set up every 8 blocks across Safe Harbor. There may be a couple thousand looters out there, but the last thing they want is to mess with us.
You're probably right. This just makes me feel a little more relaxed.
Sort of a security blanket, sir?
Ever been in combat, Corporal?
Mostly police actions.
That's good. You'll know what I'm talking about soon enough.
We drove through the financial district with its tall skyscrapers, the light of our headlights reflecting on marble and glass facades, the way it might reflect on the surface of a still lake.
Spotted any looters, sir?
I didn't answer.
You know, I've been stationed in Safe Harbor for 2 years now, and I've seen more of the town over the last 5 hours than the last 24 months. It's not a bad place, really. A little dark, maybe.
Did you see the feed from New Gibraltar?
Yeah, I'd like to see them try something like that around here. McCord would send 1,000 fighters and shoot their asses down.
From what I hear, the Separatists only had 4 ships at Gateway.
Yeah?
And from what I understand, they have over 500 ships in their fleet.
500 ships? I didn't know that.
The entrance to Fort Washington Marine Base was up ahead. You did not need to know military tactics to see that it was also on high alert. Bright lights lit the main gate to the base. Red strobes flashed on and off on the half-dozen radar dishes that spun around the wall of the fort. Unlike New Gibraltar, which looked like a modernized version of an old medieval castle, Fort Washington was a sprawling campus that took up several square miles. After the corporal dropped me off at the gate, I was led to a small interrogation room, where Jimmy Callahan and his two bodyguards waited.
What? You're a colonel now? You must have run away from something really big this time. Know what I mean?
I don't know what you mean.
Allow me to explain. You run away from the battle at Little Man, and they make you lieutenant. Now, in 2 short weeks, you're a speckin' colonel. What did you do, run away from New Gibraltar?
That's clever. Don't you think that's clever?
I looked over to Silent Tommy. He did not answer.
How about you, Eddie? Don't you think Jimmy's joke is clever?
See, now, Harris, they don't want to answer because they're scared of you. They don't have anything you want. Now, me... I have information you want, so I'm not scared. In fact, I think it's about time you did me some favors.
Really? You don't think saving your ass from Patel was enough?
I've been thinking about that. And I don't think Patel was after me. I think he was after you. Know what I mean? I never did anything to Billy. What would he have against me?
Well, there is this little issue about you fingering him to the Marines.
You cannot possibly be talking about yourself, Harris. You're not the Marines. Hell, you're a speckin' deserter. And as far as saving my ass, who says you saved it? Tommy and Eddie were there. They came out just fine, except for what you did to them. And where did I end up? I ended up in Fort Friggin' Washington, the biggest shithole on New Columbia. I figure you did nothing for me. The way I figure it, you owe me.
Sounds like you have it all figured out.
I started for the door.
Where you going?
Oh, didn't you hear? Your buddies from the Confederate Arms are getting ready to bag this planet. Should be quite a reunion. Their fleet will bombard this base until it's defenseless, then they'll probably send down commandos to nuke it. That's what they did on Gateway. Of course, Billy the Butcher probably didn't have an old pal like you that he wanted to bust out of Gateway Outpost. You did know that they evacuated New Columbia?
So I hear.
If I were you, Jimmy, I'd be thinking about how I might get off this planet. They planted hot bombs around the base on Gateway. You know what that means? It means that most of the jarheads who were in that building are alive and melting at this very moment. Mop them up with a sponge and you'll pull off their skin. And those boys were wearing radiation-proof armor. The lucky ones got cooked on the spot. They weren't wearing armor, just like you're not wearing armor. Lucky you. You will probably die just like that. One moment you're praying, God, please don't let them nuke me. The next minute, you're face-to-face with God, and he says, about that prayer.
What do you want?
Where is the GC fleet?
How the spec should I know?
You said you knew.
I asked what I would get if I led you to that fleet. I didn't say I knew where it was. I just wanted to know what it would be worth to me.
You wanted to show off.
What? Well, yeah. Yeah, maybe.
What is the Hinode fleet?
Never heard of it.
Right before the attack on New Gibraltar, the intelligence network intercepted signals referring to the Hinode fleet. Is that what your MOGAT buddies call the Galactic Central Fleet?
I don't know.
How do the Japanese figure into this? Are they in with the MOGATs?
Who the spec are the Japanese?
Refugees from Ezer Cree. Are they part of the Confederate arms?
How should I know?
How about your pal Billy the Butcher? Where is Patel?
I don't know. Someone else always arranged our meetings.
Who was that?
You could visit Bat. He's your best bet. If anyone can answer your questions, it's Bat.
Who is Bat?
Bat is Bartholomew Wingate. He introduced me to Patel.
MOGAT or Confederate?
Well, neither. He's one of yours. I guess patriotism isn't his bag. Know what I mean?
He's a punk like you?
He's much bigger than me. You might say he has his own army.
I thought you had one, too.
Oh, I do. But it's not as good as Bat's. He's got a lot more clout around here than me. He knows everything and everybody.
Great. Only we can't find Bat. We just evacuated the planet.
Oh, you don't have to worry about that. He's still in safe harbor. He's just up the road. He's the commander at the army base.
Let me get this straight.
Lieutenant Colonel Bernie Phillips looked confused.
Your prisoner claims that Colonel Wingate is selling supplies to the Confederates?
That's right.
Bullshit.
We sat in an observation room in the brig. Behind Phillips, the video screens showed the room in which Callahan and his bodyguards sat idly waiting for me.
How well do you know Wingate?
I've known Bat 3 years now, ever since I transferred in.
So you're friends?
I can't stand the son of a bitch. He thinks he's the king of the goddamn planet just because he has a bigger base. Command airlifts our supplies in through his base. The prick makes me fill out so many forms to get my stuff you'd think he owned it. He's always showing off. He must come from a rich family. Lives like a friggin' king.
Let's see here. Your supplies come through his base, and he acts like he owns them. Is that right?
Right.
And he lives like a king, but you don't think he's selling?
Bust Bat Wingate? You think we could shoot him for this?
Once this is over, I'll hand you the gun. For now, I need him alive. If my hunch is right, Wingate might be able to lead me to the Confederate fleet.
Just remember, I get to shoot him when you're done with him.
Deal.
What's our first step?
It was late at night and the sky over the city was black. I crept through the alley behind a row of restaurants until I could see the roadblock. My target came in the form of a sergeant who was touring roadblocks to keep the men alert. He drove a Jeep. He drove alone.
What is your specking problem? What is wrong with you damn idiots? How dare you fall asleep on my watch, you specking maggots?
He was kind enough to line the men up at attention in just the right angle so that neither he nor they were facing in my direction. Then he paced back and forth in front of the line like a caged animal.
Every speckin' one of you is gonna get written up for this. I will personally make sure you eat shit for this.
Phillips, I found our guy.
I spoke over a comlink stem in my glove. The colonel had volunteered to direct this operation himself. He and five of his men hid a few blocks away, waiting for me to locate and mark a target. They had two special jeeps that had been decked out for night operations. Unlike other jeeps, these units had absolutely silent engines that could only be detected with sound equipment. Since these jeeps were also made for night operations, they had night for day scanning built into their windshields. They had discrete lights and searchlights, but with that night for day scanning, you could drive stealth jeeps black.
What you got?
A single passenger and a stealth bug.
Officer or enlisted man?
Does it matter? You're in either way, right?
We were going to kidnap the man and use his ID and vehicle to break into Fort Clinton.
If we have to knock somebody up, I'd rather hit a synthetic.
He's a sergeant.
Perfect. Can you mark him?
Hiding in the darkness of the alley behind some trash cans and a stack of crates, I shined a laser pointer on one of the rear tires of the Jeep. My laser pointer cast a red beam that was as thin as a sewing needle. It illuminated a tiny red spot, no bigger than a mouse's eye, on the side of the tire. I kept the light steady for 20 seconds.
How the spec do you plan on catching criminals? Are you on guard duty or vacation? I asked you a question!
Guard duty!
Guard duty? Well, that must be why you ladies are not wearing bathing suits.
You got him?
Yeah, he's marked.
Now if he would just shut up and drive.
So you ladies think you can keep this block safe? I'm not sure who I would bet on if it comes down to you five spec suckers against a group of kindergartners. You need to be alert. Do you hear me, soldiers? Alert! A-L-E-R-T!
I could not help myself. I painted the laser across the sergeant's A-L-E-R-T ass. The soldiers were too busy looking him in the eye to see a filament-wide laser beam shining on his butt. A few minutes later, the sergeant climbed into his Jeep. I quietly walked through the alley. A stealth Jeep filled with Marines met me at the end of the alleyway.
I don't know where you marked the target that second time, but it's a good thing you did. This guy drives like a friggin' maniac. That second mark is a lot clearer.
Our driver watched the road through a night-for-day lens in the windshield. A radar panel on the dashboard showed our position, the sergeant's position, and the position of our second stealth Jeep, along with any nearby Army vehicles. Sergeant Target was on his way to the next barricade, 3 miles away. His car swerved severely as he drove. Our Jeeps, driving on parallel roads, flanked him on either side.
What's the matter with him?
Probably drinking and driving.
Was he drunk?
He's a sergeant. You can't tell without a blood test. Looking at the map, I saw that our sergeant was still 1 mile from the next barricade.
Last chance to back out.
Phillips picked up the microphone.
Take him.
Our driver accelerated. Looking at the map, I saw that the driver in the other Jeep had also picked up some speed. We streaked ahead for 2 blocks and gained a good lead, then swerved around the next corner and planted ourselves in the middle of the road. Using a computer to aim our searchlights on the sergeant, we leapt from the car and drew our weapons. Our second Jeep pulled in behind the sergeant. Once our lights went on, the other driver flashed his too. And now the brain-dead sergeant, Mr. A-L-E-R-T, did exactly what we hoped he would do. Instead of hunkering in his Jeep and calling in his situation, he grabbed his weapon and stepped onto the street. The searchlights blinded him, and he stood with his arms over his eyes, too dumb to move. I approached from the front. The searchlight shone over my shoulder.
Hey, who are you?
Are you drunk, Sergeant?
Then my right fist slammed into his jaw. The drivers in the stealth Jeeps cut their searchlights as I knelt beside the fallen Army man and stripped him down to his underwear. I took his uniform, wallet, ID, and dog tags. These articles I placed on the hood of his car. Then I stripped my clothes off and handed them to Phillips.
Damn, Harris, you didn't need to do that.
The last thing he heard was drunk.
So?
The word will stay fresh in his subconscious. It'll be the first thing he thinks of when he wakes up.
Does it work that way?
It does with me.
Good thinking.
I nodded to Phillips and climbed into the Army Jeep. Using the dome light in the roof, I examined my dog tags for a name. First Sergeant Mark Hopkins. I found a circuitous route that took me through alleys until I passed all but one final guard station. The soldiers guarding that checkpoint would expect an Army sergeant to come up the street. So I pulled onto good old Main Street, Safe Harbor, a 6-lane thoroughfare leading to an endless suspension bridge that spanned a great river. The soldiers were far more alert than the ones at the other barricades I'd seen. They held their guns at the ready. Men sat in the machine gun nests on either side of the bridge. Soldiers sat behind the wheels of the jeeps and all-terrain vehicles on the edges of the post. None of this would matter as long as I did not do anything stupid. I slowed my jeep and coasted up to the barricade before coming to a stop. Somebody flashed a spotlight on me. The glare through the windshield was blinding. I lifted a hand to block the glare as I opened my door.
May I see your identification?
A soldier stepped up. I felt through my pockets and produced Sergeant Hopkins' ID.
Could you cut the light?
The soldier handed back my ID. The barricade slid open.
You're clear.
I didn't even bother going to Wingate's office. Instead, I decided the officer housing units would be the most likely place to find him. I moved behind a stand of trees to watch his house. Wingate's front door was about 10 yards ahead of me. His house was easy to spot. His porch lights blazed while every other house on the block was dark. An hour passed. I remained crouched,
hidden from Wingate's house by trees and a shrub. An observant driver might have spotted me among the trees, but no one came down this road. The base was at high alert, and the officers were at their stations. When the enemy finally appeared, they were dressed in army fatigues. The jeep rolled up the street right past me. It parked in front of Colonel Wingate's yard, and two men climbed out.
I told you this was the right street.
The speaker had a single bar on his fatigues. Had he not been an enemy commando, that bar would have made him a lieutenant in the army.
I spotted the house.
The other man wore the same clever disguise. They were wolves in wolves' clothing.
How hard was that? It's the only house with its lights on.
An angry-looking Wingate came to the door before they reached it.
Ready, Colonel.
Wingate turned off the lights outside his house and locked the door behind him. He did not speak as he walked over to the stealth jeep in his driveway, a rucksack dangling over his shoulder. He climbed into the back seat. I could see his head through the rear window. The commandos climbed into the front seats, and the jeep rolled out of the driveway. Colonel Wingate and his commando escort drove with their headlights off. Since their stealth vehicle had night-for-day vision built into its windshield, that was no problem for them. To avoid being spotted, I also drove with my headlights off. Before taking me into town to kidnap the Army soldier, Colonel Phillips had shown me several maps of Fort Clinton and the surrounding area. There was no way a sellout like Wingate was going to ride out the attack. His soldiers were going to die. The Pentagon would send men to survey the base, and there would be huge inventory discrepancies. Even if Wingate survived the attack, he would be arrested and killed in the aftermath. His Confederate arms pals might not care if he got himself executed, but he might spill some important information in the process. To keep him quiet, they either needed to kill him or get him off the planet. Either way, they would need to send down a transport with a team of commandos. When that transport returned to the fleet, I aimed to hitch a ride. By studying the maps, Phillips and I located the most likely spot for an enemy transport to land. It was only an educated guess, but it proved right. Driving almost blind, I headed up a slow grade toward the raised parade grounds along the eastern gate of the base. This area was dark and mostly empty. Sure enough, every few seconds, I spotted just a glimpse of the phantom black car in the darkness. A half mile ahead of me, Wingate's jeep slowed as it passed through a poorly lit guard station. The gate at the guard station raised as Wingate approached. A commando left the station and climbed into Wingate's stealth jeep. As if this were a cue, the attack commenced the moment Wingate's car left the base. It came in the form of a silvery red beam that poured out of the night sky like a translucent pillar. I watched this scene unfold as I drove, and I looked at my wristwatch to mark the time. Once 8 minutes had passed, I knew the whole thing would be over. When I reached the gate, I noticed the shattered glass of the security booth and knew that the commandos had slaughtered the men left to guard this gate. There was no blood, no major destruction. The commandos had probably sneaked up to the gate on their way into the base. Behind me, lasers rained down from above. I drove through the gate at 80 miles per hour. How long had the attack lasted so far? I looked at my watch. Only 20 seconds had passed since the first beam rolled down from the sky. I saw no trace of Wingate's jeep in front of me and had no time left for discretion. Turning my headlights on, I raced down tree-lined lanes and into the forested countryside. I looked at my wristwatch and saw the timer hand sweep past the 12. 1 full minute had passed since that first laser attack. Why had I not started timing when I spotted the commandos? Why had I gone to the base instead of simply hiding out here? I doused my headlights. Up ahead, the white light of arc lamps shined through a grove. The trees blocking the glare created a strobe effect, as if I were watching an ancient silent movie. I pulled off the road and skidded to a halt in the mud. I jumped out of my jeep. A good 100 feet into the woods, men in green uniforms loaded small stacks of crates into an antique-looking military transport. Other men with guns circled the area looking for folks like me. Here, I had a stroke of luck. These men were dressed in army fatigues that looked precisely like mine. They were camouflaged to look like the soldiers at Fort Clinton. I drew closer to my target, a lone man with an M27. He had blonde hair. We looked nothing alike, but I did not think it would matter. Barely lifting my feet, I rushed forward, staying in a slight crouch. I leaped forward, fastening my right hand around the boy's chin and anchoring my grip on the back of his neck. I quickly approached the transport.
Hurry up, asshole!
I nodded to the commando as I started up the ramp, and the doors closed behind me.